Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order February 18th, 2022. Today is co-chair Senator Bishop, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Hoffman, myself, Stedman. We have a quorum. We may have other members calling in or showing up depending on other meetings that they're attending.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson is online.
Senator Olson is online. I see him now on the screen here. Okay, so today, as we always do every year, we have a discussion on the retirement system, both the public employees and the teachers' retirement, what we commonly call PERS and TERS. We've asked the director of the Division of Retirement and Benefits, along with some other supporting folks, to come forward and talk to us today. Mr. Ajay Desi? Well, I'm going to mispronounce it, so I pronounced it before the meeting correctly, but now I'm butchering it, so I have to apologize. But come on forward. He's jumping in the chair. Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer, Division of Retirement and Benefits, is also here. Emily Ritchie, Chief Health Officer. And then we have Mindy Voigt, Benefit Manager, online. We've had, obviously, we're dealing with COVID issues and general colds and stuff, so we have some folks here, some folks not. But if they can come forward, please, and at least whoever's going to lead the presentation. And then we've got these muffles on, so please speak loudly into the mics so we can clearly grasp what you're saying. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record. Take us through the presentation. We will be covering and talking about the unfunded liability, overfunding of health care, length of the unfunded liability, and potential alterations that we may consider this year or in the future to alleviate some of the financial burdens on our communities. And Senator Wilson has just joined us. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Stedman and committee members. Thank you for inviting us today for the Alaska Public Employees Retirement System, PERS, and Teachers Retirement System, TERS, annual update. For the record, my name is Ajay Desai, Division Director of Retirement and Benefits under the Department of Administration. For the history, I have been with the division for the past 5 years. Since January 2017, I bring with me about 34 years of experience in the benefit administration arena. With me today, I have, as Chair Stedman mentioned, Chief Financial Officer Kevin Worley, Chief Health Administrator Emily Ritchie. Unfortunately, Jim Puckett, Chief Pension Officer, came under the weather, so Mindy Voigt will be online should we have any questions. And now, without further ado, allow me to begin the presentation. Number two slide shows the Alaska Retirement Management Board, otherwise known as AMBOARD, organization chart for how the two departments cohesively work together with the AMBOARD. Effective October 1, 2005, the board's primary mission is to serve as a trustee of the asset of state's retirement systems, the state of Alaska supplemental annuity plan, deferred compensation plans, and the Alaska Retiree Healthcare Trust. Learning from the past and a few questions, we have made little changes in this slide. As you can see it, on the right side, we are showing under the Division of Retirement Benefits, the valuation actuary Buck. And we are also showing reviewer actuary Gabriel Roder Smith under the AMBOARD section. And I believe that we have also invited Buck to be on the line should we have any actuarial question, learning from the past presentation. Moving on to the next slide, this one shows the membership. As of June 30th, 2021, and we are over a little bit over 100,000, about 100,000 102,901 people, one members actually. And the ratio between the defined benefit plans versus defined contribution plans shows in the last column 31% versus 69, so it's more like a 70-30. Moving on to slide number 4. This slide shows investment experience. We had an excellent year. As you know, the actual value of assets were reinitialized to equal fair value as of 2014 with the $3 billion infusion from HB 119. Beginning in 2015, the valuation method recognizes 20% of the investment gain or loss each year for a period of 5 years, also known as a smoothing. As you can see in line 1, the expected rate of return was 7.38, assume actual earning rate, which is the line number 1. Comparatively, on the line number 2, based on a fair value assets, the return for 2021 was a historical, phenomenal returns, the 30% under PERS and 30.1% under the TERS. However, based on the actual value of asset, we would recognize 11.6 under the both plan, again, otherwise known as a smoothing over the 5 year period. Moving on to the slide number 5. Based on the returns that you saw on our previous page, you will see a dramatic difference on this page and on the values and results. If I were to draw your attention on the middle section, on 2020, we were at 79.3% funded under PERS. That jumped to 85.5% combined for both pension and healthcare. For TERS, similarly, 86.6% jumped to 92.5%. And if you see the last two lines, the last line shows 97.4% funded for PERS and 105.4% under TERS. So if you would see the line above, that shows $579 million as unfunded liability based on the fair value of assets. And same if you were to add on to the TERS, negative 537, which pretty much voids each other. So it's a significant year and exciting, thrilling news for us, all of us actually, and for all the membership of the both system, PERS and TERS. That plan is in a very strong position. Moving on to the next slide, this shows the same table, but fund status for pension only. And middle section shows under 2021, pension is funded at 67.9% under as the actuarial value of liability, and TERS is at 79%. And similarly, if you were to see this same funded ratio based on the fair value of assets, that is at 77.3% and 90% for TERS. Would you like to add, Chief O'Worley, the information beneath? Note.
Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer, Division of Retirement and Benefits. One of the things we looked at as we were preparing this particular schedule was to look at where were we compared to last year on a funded level projected to 2039, which has been the anticipated 100% funding of the PERS and TERS pension and healthcare trust funds. At the time of the 2020 release valuation report, which was done June of this 2021, it showed that we would be 93.4% funded on the PERS pension trust and 96.3% by June 2039. On the back of a napkin, more like a dinner napkin, not a bar napkin, you know, we've projected that the 100% funded level will be reached about 2 or 3 years earlier than the projections that we had last year.
Yep. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the difference between actuarial value of assets and fair value of assets?
And go ahead and re-explain that and tell us why we even have an actuarial asset value.
To the chair, I'm sorry, I didn't hear your last question.
Why we even have an actuarial value? Why do we have two values? We've got the market value and the actuarial value. There's got to be a reason for that. I think that's the Senator Wilkowski's asked for what the difference is, but I want you to explain why we even have two values.
Understood. To the chair, we have David Kirshner from Buck Global, who is our consulting actuary, and I think it would be best to hear it straight from our actuary. So, David, if you could please respond to that question.
I can take care of running the meeting.
Good.
Go ahead, Mr.
Good morning. Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Mr. Kirshner, if you could identify yourself for the record, please, and who you represent, and then help us with why we have two different asset values that we're dealing with.
Okay. My name is David Kirshner. I'm an actuary with Buck. We work with the Division of Retirement Benefits. Just want to make sure that you can hear me okay.
Yes.
Okay, great. The reason why we have an actuarial value, let me just explain the difference between the two. Market value is the fair value of the investments base, taken strictly directly from the financial statements. The actuarial value is, as Ajay and Kevin were saying earlier, is a smooth value, where we recognize every year we compare the actual market return versus the expected market return, which is 7.38%. And if the actual market return is greater than the expected return, that produces a gain, and vice versa, a loss. Those gains and losses are recognized over a five-year period. So they're recognized 20% per year over a five-year period. The reason, there's one reason only why we use an actuarial value or a smooth value, and that is to minimize the volatility of the state's contributions that would result from swings in market values either up or down. So if we did not have a smooth value, and this year our market values are considerably higher because of the 30% return, we would see the state's contributions for both PERS and TERS decrease considerably from where they were projected to be and where they were the prior year because of those market gains. Similarly, if we experience a market correction, for example, in FY22, if we didn't have a smooth value, that would produce a market loss, that market correction, and then we would see a spike in state contributions. So to minimize those declines and spikes in the state's contributions, we use the actuarial value, which attempts to smooth out the volatility of the market returns.
So dealing with your market returns, it's been presented here that we had phenomenal returns last year. Do returns regress to the mean, or should we be expecting these type of returns going forward?
David Kirshner from Buck. I'm not an investment expert, so I can't say for sure. But I don't think anybody even would have predicted returns as high as 30%. It's very unusual. If we have a really good year in the past that tended to be, say, a return of around maybe 15% or 12%. That's considered a favorable return, and then on the flip side, we have experienced returns where the market return was say 2 or 3% or 0% in some years following, like the 2008 correction, the market return was actually negative. So it's hard to predict what's going to happen, but I think it's over time, we would expect the market returns to converge toward the mean, the expected return of 7.38 over the long term.
Correct. You have a follow-up, Senator Wilikowski, on that? Have we in the past ever used and ignored the actuarial valuation of the assets, the smoothing, and just concentrated on the market value when we set our contribution rates?
This is David Kirscher from Buck. Well, for sure, since 2014, we have used the smooth value. I'm not aware of if we go back in time, if there was ever a point where we were using fair market value, but it's a common practice among retirement plans across the country, like PERS and TERS, to use a smoothing method because of the undesirable effects on contribution volatility due to market swings. So it's very common to use a smooth value, and we're using a five-year smoothing period, which is also the most prevalent period, a smoothing period for those plans that use a smoothing method.
Yeah, we have a question from Senator Wilikowski, but I didn't mean it as a trick question. The answer is no, we don't use market values. Yes, we use actuarial values, and we have since for the last, well over the last 20 some years. I think the last time we might have deviated from that would have been at the end of the last century. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Do you know how the state compares our funded status versus other public and private pensions around the country in terms of funded status?
And just, Mr. Kirscher, I'm not sure we have who would be best to answer that question. Mr. Worley, do you want to try to help us with that?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski.
Could you please pull your mic up, and you'll have to bark into it with these masks.
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski. Annually, the National Association of State Retirement Administrators regularly monitors 119 plans. And within the last report, which was through June 30, 2020, we do not have 2021 yet. That won't be issued until probably October or November. But in terms of the accrued liability, the state of Alaska, PERS was 78 and TERS was 98, where the actuarial accrued liability was highest for like a California retirement system, CalPERS. So our liability, accrued liability, is toward the lower end. In terms of asset size, obviously the California PERS would have the highest asset value. We're down at 82 on PERS and 98 on TERS, comparatively speaking. In terms of unfunded liability being the largest unfunded liability, down to actually a few positive or overfunded plans, Alaska PERS was 61 and TERS was 85. And then in terms of funded ratio, where an overfunded plan in Washington was at 116%, TERS was 54th at 75%, and PERS was 89th at 63.6. But again, these were 2020 numbers. I would surmise that for 2021, you know, plans overall were making the same amount of money, so we're probably in a similar situation.
So let's put a finer point on it. I think if we look back, Alaska was one of the few states that actually combined its health along with its pension. Most states ignored their health liability, where Alaska, for well over two decades, has recognized that. So could you help us with the accounting standard changes briefly, without getting too carried away, on the changes the last few years, several years, where all of the states and corporations have to recognize that healthcare liability on their books that we had already done?
Through the chair, or to the chair. Within the last 10 years, the Governmental Accounting Standard Board has issued accounting statements for both pension and health trust plans, as well as for employers that participate in public employees and teacher retirement systems. One of the first requirements was that pension and health care plans would, within their financial statements, issue a funded status of both pension and health care trusts, recognizing contributions to pensions and health care. And we report for Alaska PERS and TERS those within our financial statements. Annually, we take the net pension liability, which we've reflected on this slide here, and we allocate that to all the participating employers based on an allocation provided by the AICPA and GASB.
I guess the point of the question was that Alaska has recognized the pension and healthcare liability far earlier than most states. And most states had a significant unfunded health care, and we'd been addressing it for well over two decades, which helps get us in the position we are today, which is, for those watching at home, if you can't wade through the gobbledygook today, we're in good shape, a heck of a lot better shape than we've been in a long, long time, and we're seeing some light at the end of the tunnel. So this is a good news presentation today. We don't want to get lost in the weeds, but we are having this discussion whether on the recognition of market values, which would say we're pretty much fully funded, versus a smoothing, which says we're still a little bit underfunded, but not at an alarming area. And so we're in good shape no matter how you want to cut the pie. And then the discussion, I think, of the concern is that we don't let our guard down when we see the end of the light at the end of the tunnel and have a repeat of the late 90s when we had what appeared to be strong funding levels, which in reality were not, and we flipped the whole pension system upside down. So we want to make sure that doesn't happen. That's part of the point of many questions today headed down the table on this issue. And I think we need to be careful or try to put some historical context in some of the discussion, because it's not something that most people pay much attention to, or frankly even are used to the lingo that's used in the retirement arena.
And to the chair, just to add to that, one of the things that was a result of after that 2000 issue that you bring up, the creation of the ARM board, and then the creation of the statute that has a secondary or review actuary that is the responsibility and reports to the ARM board, and they review the work that the consulting actuary that is contracted by the Division of Retirement and Benefits. So there is an extra set of eyes on that actuarial report.
Correct, and I didn't bring that up, but that is correct. We have all the numerics double-checked.
Yes.
So we have any follow-up questions on this? We'll go into Senator.
Just a comment, Mr. Worley. Thank you for you guys showing up today, Emily and Ajay. Appreciate you guys being here. But I just want to reemphasize again that it doesn't go unnoticed that the if we hadn't made the $3 billion deposit then we made in 14, these numbers would look a lot different.
The chair, Senator, yes, absolutely true. That $3 billion infusion in 2014 created compounding effect, and what result we are seeing today is definitely cannot be ignored of that monies.
Right. Okay, so when I've asked, we're going to be later in the presentation, but I've asked the department to give us an idea on if we did an equity infusion into the liability that's left of a substantially smaller than we did before, what would be the outcome? And the point of the analysis or the question to them is that would enable a lower contribution rate going forward in the operating budget, not only for the state, but for all the municipalities. So if we could, we'll go ahead and continue, and we'll get into some of the more positive opportunities that face us, unlike several years ago when we were struggling with a whole different set of issues here at the table.
For the record, this is Ajay Desai. Chair Stedman, yes, we will show a little bit in a few slides further down the road. We have done some calculations to show the impact. If you were to infuse additional monies into the PERS and TERS, how would future look like, the future projections amount would look like? We'll go through that in after a few slides. Okay. Moving on to the slide number 7. This one shows the funded status, very similar table, specifically for the healthcare. Where you can see all the red numbers, those are overfunded amounts. Underfunded actually shows as a positive number, but because it's negative, these are all overfunded amounts. And based on the funded ratio, based on the actual value, it's at 125.2% for PERS, 134.2% for TERS. And if you were to look at the same numbers based on the fair value of assets, 142.7% for PERS and 152.8% for TERS as of 2021.
Okay. Follow our question from Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. Could someone give me just a brief historical rationale for why healthcare and pensions are separate?
I will begin, Chair Stedman, through the chair. Senator, I'll begin the answer, but I'll invite Emily Rashid after my answers. The pension, defined benefit pension plan is known as, because it's a defined benefit by its design, it's a guaranteed benefit. And the benefit, those are guaranteed, cannot be changed over the period for regardless of whatever funding status is for the DB plan. Participants under the plan actively continue to grow the accrue the benefits. As they accrue the benefit, the liability increases. And if the two factors in there, the financial and demographics changes year to year, makes the difference in the funding level. And that is the reason that actuary look at it every 4 years to determine the rate of returns. As far as the health plan goes, it's very dynamic. It's extremely dynamic. That is, you may see that today is very heavily overfunded, but one experience could bring these results in different direction, or it might dilute. However, the key factor behind these results are that in the last 5 years, the division has made a significant changes and the implementation under the direction of Emily Ritchie that is phenomenal, and we have done many major changes, and we'll continue to doing additional changes in the future to keep this health plan funded beyond the level as we're expecting. Nationally, the trend is at around 8 to 9% for every year. State of Alaska trend, you will see in the last page towards the end, the trend is completely different because of we are closing it, watching it very closely and monitoring it very closely. We are not missing any single opportunity to find a way that which way we can save the money by keeping the benefit at the same level or rather increase for both employees and for retirees. Ms. Rishi?
And we want to pick the pace up, so go ahead and try to help us if you could. And
through the chair, Emily Ricci, Chief Health Administrator in the Division of Retirement and Benefits, and Senator Wilkowski, regarding why they're accounted differently, I can't so much speak to the accounting, but I can tell you that, the division has really focused on identifying ways where it can offer the same set of benefits, but offer them at lower prices, whether that's through more competitive negotiations with our pharmacy benefit manager or through the implementation of a group Medicare Part D prescription drug program, which we'll talk about later on in this slide. We're also seeing a demographic shift. As retirees age, they become eligible for Medicare, and when Medicare becomes primary, the plan moves into a secondary position, and that is also providing some financial relief for the health plan.
Okay. So we're going to go on to the next slide, and I'll watch the clock. I'm going to try to get us done on time.
Thank you, Chair Shedman. For the record, Ajay Desai. This slide number 8 shows the historical ratio, funded ratio from 2001 through to 2021. As you can see it, that it took big dive in 2009. After 2009, we are back at 85.5% for PERS and 92.5% for TERS. This just shows the visual graph of the history. The slide number 9 is showing the similar graph for the unfunded actuarial liability. Significantly, you know, back in 2013 was the highest at nearly about over $12 billion. We are today at under $4 billion, combining both for PERS and TERS. And again, this is the result of the 30% return, phenomenal work done by Arm Board and Department of Revenue. We couldn't thank them enough for where we are today. This is actually making a history of having this kind of return and seeing these results. Okay. This slide shows, slide number 10, shows employer contribution rates. There was a question that came along based on the Amber meeting that what are these $88 million savings that we are referring to? And this table kind of breaks it down how actuary determines the rate based on the total payroll for PERS and TERS separately. So the top line shows about $2.4 billion of total payroll that includes defined benefit plan as well as defined contribution plan employees and annual payroll. And based on the normal cost that they accrued during the last year, also the past service cost under the DB pension plan, the cost for defined benefit health plan, normal cost, because it's overfunded, there is no past service cost for the health plan, and the cost for the DCR plan, and they determine the actual percentage that will require as a contribution.
Can we stop for a minute?
Yes, sir.
Can you tell me what the normal cost is and what a DB is? And let's try not to use acronyms. So tell me what a normal cost is and what is a past service cost also, if you can help me with those.
Sure. The defined under normal cost under the defined benefit pension plan is the cost for the year, valuation year, where employees have accrued additional benefits. So that cost is the additional cost compared to the cost prior to the, up to the last valuation date. And I'll invite probably David Kirshner from Buck to provide more detail about this information and any questions regarding the slides and breakdowns. I would probably, it would be helpful to hear more details from the actuary himself.
Well, I think
himself.
The point of the question was so the public can follow these terms. So what I'm hearing you tell me, the normal cost is the annual contribution for the annual year of service. So it's the amount of money that the benefits for the employee, what it cost that they accrued that particular year. And if everything worked in a perfect world, that contribution then would carry on through their retirement and until they're gone, and we would not see the next item, which is a past service cost, that wouldn't materialize. Is that correct?
That is correct. A Senator statement for the record, Ajay Desai again. The normal, let's assume that the plan is completely frozen as it is today, and we have no participants or members actively working under the DB plan. Then there will not be any normal cost because there is no additional accrual benefits. But because we have actively participating members still exist under the DB plan, they are continually accruing the benefit each year. The additional cost is known as a normal cost. We need to add that cost for the value up to the previous year. So if the plan is frozen, what would be the liability for the plan? That would be the past service cost, basically. Those are the costs that we are required to pay. If the plan is 100% funded, then past service cost would not exist. Just like if you see under the defined benefit health plan, we only have normal cost, which is also negative because of overfunded. But we do not have past service cost because there is no more liability. So if the plan were stopped and there are no members, there will be no additional cost, and we have enough money under the plan funded level that we would not require additional contributions.
Okay. And then you might as well add in, we made a change in where we include all the payroll.
Yes.
The contribution to help alleviate this issue, I think, if I remember right. Could you help us with that?
Yes. Chair Steadman, this is Ajay again for the record. As I was showing line number one, it shows the total payroll for the purse. And based on the actuarial calculation, the actuary came up with 27.63% of contribution, required contributions, and it shows a breakdown above the table. And also shows a dollar value next to it. But due to the health plan overfunded, it was adopted by the board in October that $0 contributions for both for PERS and for TERS. And as you can see, those red numbers, 68 million under the health plan side, I mean the PERS side, and 20 million under the TERS side. If we were to remove those, what would be the impact? And that shows in the following chart, following table, that state of Alaska contribution will still remain the same as 27.63%. And if you notice, the contribution would be 328 million before and 24.79 after reducing the healthcare cost. The non-state employers' contribution that is set for 22%, capped as 22%, remains the same, 267 million for both before and after. And if you look at the additional state contributions, 5.63%, which was 68,475, that drops to 2.79. And similarly, the same table as illustration shows for the TERS plan. So end result is that by not contributing the overfunded healthcare trust, 68 million from PERS and 20 million from TERS brought a savings of nearly $89 million.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This sort of goes back to my last question about why we separate these out. I guess you do it for accounting purposes, but the reality is that public employees and teachers expect that they will have their pensions and their health care paid for. And just because one is overfunded doesn't mean you can cut, you should be able to cut the other one. And, or just because one is overfunded doesn't mean you stop funding that one. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me to do that.
We're going to walk into that. The question that Senator Wilkowski put on the table is one of the points of the meeting. We're trying to set the stage for that discussion. There is concern from many members of the committee. There's questions of, you know, pass the red face test, I don't want to really use the word legally, but in the regulatory world of pensions. So we want to touch on that. Are you guys going to walk into that a little later in the presentation, or you want to try to tackle it now? What do you want to do?
To the chair, we actually have a slide that addresses that. Okay.
So let's wait for that slide, Senator Wilkowski, because that is one of the issues we have to discuss and decide at the table here.
Ready? Next slide, actually.
Ted, go ahead and continue.
Okay, so this slide shows the additional state contribution projected. This is based on the October 2021 meeting in the onboard. Adopted rates, due to the significant result returns, the previous year, the valuation numbers that was projected, it becomes completely outstanding. Outdated, I'm sorry. Apologize for the misword. So based on October 2021 meeting, these numbers are revised to show that the true realistic value of the projected additional state contributions, what it would be, look like. The PERS from 2023 to 2039, we are expecting it around $472 million. and TERS at nearly about 1.4. Total adds up to about $1.85 billion. Additional state contributions will be needed once we reach at 100%. Plan would reach at 100%.
Okay.
And this slide, number 12, this is the one that Mr. Worley was talking about. It shows the results. If we were to continue to contribute normal cost towards the healthcare trust, what would it look like versus if we did not? So this chart, I would invite Mr. Worley to explain a little bit more in detail.
To the chair, Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer, Division of Retirement and Benefits. The slide before you shows what Senator Wolakowski was asking about. If we looked at PERS and we look at making the normal cost contribution each fiscal year going forward, you would see that we would maintain a funded level well over 100%. That's based on current projections. What the board looked at in October of 2021 was what would the impact be if the rates that were adopted showed a zero contribution of the normal cost rate to the PERS Healthcare Trust. Again, we still maintain a funded level over 100%. Our board chair likened it to having a full glass of water and then trying to pour in more water on a glass that's just full. It's going to overflow. In this situation, obviously, we're looking at a glass that we're just accumulating more water, but it is projection-wise over 100% still. So, and that situation continues with TERS. We'll see that in both cases. We continue contributing a normal cost. Fund levels go up. Even without the normal cost, we're still over 115, 119%. At the low point on this graph.
Okay, so we have a couple questions, but I want you to talk about, and I don't know if stress testing, running Monte Carlo simulations on your return. What's the sensitivity of this if, you know, we just walked out of a 30% year, which is abnormally high? What happens if we walk into an abnormally low environment going forward with the upward rates of inflation and so on and so forth, because the returns have to regress to the mean. And if you're at 30%, you're not going to have 30% forever. You're going to have some pretty ugly off years to knock that average return down. Mm-hmm. So what's the sensitivity of this? That's a question.
To the chair, Kevin Worley, Chief Financial Officer. Excuse me. In the October meeting, the board members did ask, what would be the impact, what would have to be the impact of the fair value of assets just to return to 100% funded level based on fair value? And our actuaries came back and indicated that the PERS for FY22 would have to lose 20% roughly, and TERS would have to lose 25%. We then asked, because of the smoothing methodology that's used on assets, what would be the loss on, and I have to correct the bottoms part, I have actuarial, but it should be fair value. What would be the loss on fair value of assets to return to 100% funded level on an actuarial basis? PERS would have to lose 86%, and TERS inconceivably would lose 115%. And again, that's because of that five-year smoothing that we talked about. But that was a scenario that was asked for. Obviously, you know, we could project a whole bunch of different numbers, but reality is reality. So we just wanted to look at 22, what would be that case. So this was what was presented to the board.
Right. We've had numerous projections done on our revenue, and also we've had projections run on the permanent fund with some confidence intervals, 68% roughly to 95%, what have you, dealing with some of these simulations. So did you guys run those type of Monte Carlo simulations, or just pick one bad year and go to the average? Or help me a little bit about what was the composition of that analysis?
To the chair, I'll have to defer to David Kirshner to respond to that particular item.
So, David. Hey, Mr. Kirshner, can you help the committee with the distribution, potential distributions of these returns going forward, and what, and we're trying to gauge the risk level of this slide in front of us in dollar terms.
Yes, David Kirshner from Buck. The answer, the simple answer to your question is, we did not run a Monte Carlo simulation, which would generate, you know, dozens and dozens and hundreds of randomly generated returns. We did not do that. We have in the past provided projections of what would happen if not only we had unfavorable asset returns for a year or two, but also what would happen if we had unfavorable experience on the claim side. In other words, if we paid out more claims than we expected, that would increase the healthcare liabilities. And we've run some projections if we had a couple of years where we had significantly higher than expected claims. And in those projections, we're still projecting the healthcare trust to be over 100% funded. And that doesn't mean it's always going to be over 100% funded. Obviously, we can create a scenario where we have two bad years of asset returns, like negative 20% in consecutive years. That might be enough to bring the healthcare funded percentage closer to 100%. But the likelihood of having successive returns like that are fairly small.
Okay. Thanks, Senator Wilkowskis first, and Senator Bishop.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm looking at this a little bit like you have a homeowner has an electric bill and a gas bill, and they say, well, I've overpaid my gas bill, so I don't need to pay my electric bill. That's not how it works. You owe both the pension and the health care. And so the health care is funded at 113.5%, but the pension's funded at 63.6%. So I'm still not completely understanding why we're separating those two out when you have a significant underfunding of the pension. That said, I guess my question is, and I don't know how long you've been here, if you were here in the 1990s, but did our actuaries advise us in the 1990s that the state could underfund the pensions by $250 million per year and we wouldn't have a problem? Were we advised back then, to your knowledge?
Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, I wasn't around in the 90s, so I could not answer that question. But I think getting to your first comment, where we are overfunded in the health care but underfunded on the pension, the rate that was adopted chose not to fund the health care side. The pension side is still being funded. In fact, the additional state contribution that's required is currently in the operating budget. So the contributions, the contributions that are made by employers, the way the rate is currently adopted for a defined benefit member, that entire contribution is going to go to the pension. So there are contributions going to the pension plan, none going to the health care trust. Trying to remember where I was going with that. I'm sorry.
Let me back up a little bit and help with that one question that Senator Wilkowski haven't asked about in the late 90s, and I haven't looked at that data in years. But as I recall, that's what happened, along with a couple other issues. And the legislature thought that the retirement system was fully funded, and the data showed it was fully funded, but the data was flawed. And it wasn't fully funded, it was upside down. And when we worked through and straightened it out, we had a substantial liability appeared on the books. And that's where the hesitation of the committee members are. We don't want to repeat the late 90s mistake, because it came back and haunted us for two decades now. Mm. And we've put $8 billion in payments in the unfunded liability, and we owe another three or some number, depending on what number you want to grab in that arena, in that range. So that's the hesitation from the committee. even though what may appear to look overfunded today, they want to have some, that's where we're, these questions are coming at, mm-hmm. are coming down the table, is because of what happened in the 90s and the difficulty we've had in working our way out of it. And I'd like to also note, just for those watching at home, no matter what the funding ratio is, no matter what the asset value is, no matter what we choose, if it's market value or the smoothing value, it makes absolutely zero difference receiving your retirement checks and your health care benefits. That's backed up by the Constitution of the state. We could have zero in the portfolio accounts here, and we'd still have to make the payments. What we're doing here is making sure we have the funding available to ensure a smooth flow of all the benefits, and we don't have huge costs coming in one year and smaller ones in the next. So I just don't want anybody at home to construe in any of these conversations that any of their benefits are in any jeopardy whatsoever of being paid. That is not what we're talking about here today. That's backed up by the full power of the state's taxing authority and backed up by the value of the permanent fund, all assets held by the state. So I don't want any confusion in the public of what we're talking about. What we're concerned about here is we see we have a potential of getting it fully funded, and we want to keep it fully funded to minimize our cash payments every year. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You asked my question about several minutes ago. They did not run a Monte Carlo scenario on this health care.
So, okay, we have other questions. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are the retirement and benefit plans audited by two different firms to make sure that we prevent what happened in the 90s?
Pardon me? I did not hear your question.
The question is, is there a double check of the numbers? And if you could highlight again why we have two actuarial firms employed versus just one.
All right, through the chair to Senator Wilson. So the Division of Retirement and Benefits has the contract with the consulting actuary Buck, who David Kirshner works for. The ARM board, as required by statute, has a review or secondary actuary that they contract with independent from Buck. So Gabriel Roeder Smith, or GRS, is that review actuary. And they review the work that Buck does every year. So we do annual reports, annual valuation reports. Those are reviewed by GRS and then presented to the ARM board. Buck will do the presentation of their results, and then GRS comes in and does a presentation of their review work that they've done and talks about any differences, if there's any material differences that should be resolved. The last few years, the differences that we've seen are very, very, very minor, nothing statistically significant in terms of the valuation reports.
So that extra review was put in when we restructured this system over 20 years ago, not quite over 20 years ago, getting close to that, well over a decade and a half ago, to ensure that, or to minimize, not to ensure because there's no guarantees in life, but to minimize the potential of an actuarial mistake mm-hmm. and then having information that isn't as good as it should have been at this table and the wrong decision is made with not only this table, but the retirement system. So it costs us a little extra every year, but that was intentionally structured that way to have a review. And at some point in the future, that may change, but it's been going on for quite some time, and it's I think it's a good safety practice.
If I could, through the chair to Senator Wilson. Additionally, Alaska statutes require that there be a full audit of the valuation report every 4 years. So there'll be another actuary that does a full replication of a valuation report that Buck is working on. So somebody independent, again, from Buck will be hired to do a full-fledged audit and replication of the report to make sure that there's nothing, you know, nothing wrong in terms of the assumptions or calculations.
Okay.
Through the chair, if I could add as well, I think there's another element that we've kind of made some changes to in the past few years, and that has to do with the data that the division is providing to Buck and to the actuaries. And we've improved, I think, the level of detail and accuracy in the data that they're able to use in calculating their projections. And that's been an improvement in terms of accurately predicting what can be volatile costs on the healthcare side as well.
So, Senator Bishop.
Ms. Ritchie, thank you for that. I'm going to take a stab at your good work down there. Would that new data that you're getting, would that be a contributing factor of those that of us that are maybe 65 and older and not on the Medicaid's primary and in the state's secondary to help alleviate the cost?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop. That is some of the information that I think we're being more precise in terms of being able to give very accurate counts to Buck in terms of, you know, where members are at across the age spectrum, in terms of whether they're a year out from becoming Medicare age eligible or, you know, whether they've already become Medicare age eligible. So that is absolutely a contributor in terms of getting more accurate information.
Thank you.
Okay. So let's continue.
Chair Stedman, this is Ajay Desai for the record. I just want to add one more comment for Senator Wilkowski, that even though we are overfunded under the health trust side and a little bit underfunded for the pension, we could not under, they both are separate health trust under one single purse system. So even though if you look at the purse as a single umbrella, they're individual two trusts, and we could not commingle the funds between one versus the other. That's another reason that we continue to collect the actual cost that is needed for the pension funds separately versus we look at the health trust separately, and since it's overfunded, the decision was made to this, collect the contribution zero. Okay. And it will be looked at it annually to reevaluate next year's based on the situation, the rate will be determined. Moving on to the slide number 13. This shows the additional state contributions history as Chair Stedman mentioned earlier. This is the number that shows, a slide that shows about $8 billion plus amount contributed to the both systems. And you can see the line number under 2015. That's $1 billion infusion under the purse and $2 billion under the TERS are showing as a total $3 billion. And the results you have seen in the funded ratio in the subsequent years. Moving on to the slide number 14, this one shows the historical rate of returns and funded ratio from 96 throughout to 2021. And if you were to average this for over past 30 years, the average rate of return is 8.33 under PERS and 8.37 under the TERS. And prior to 96, this table doesn't really show the numbers, but if you were to go beyond 96, there was the rate of assumptions was about 9%, and then from 96 forward it shows 8%. So one question if it arises that 8%, as David Kirshner earlier mentioned, was predicted over the long period of term, are we meeting that goal? So if you look 30 years after, our return shows about 8.33%. It's right on above the target. And if you were to exclude the 2021 returns, you would think that, oh, that's how because of the 30% return. That ratio would for the last 30 years would be at 7.7%.
Okay. And I would just caution everybody, when you look at 2001 and previous to that, those funding ratios, I'd take them with a grain of salt. I wouldn't believe what's on the paper. If that was in fact true, we want to have the thing blow up. So we did not go back and restate those numbers historically, which we talked about at the time, somewhere around 2005, 2006, and we just thought we'd just go on. But they're, in my opinion, it got virtually no value. And that's on the funding ratio, not the rate of return. Mm. I don't want to have people misconstrue. And that's what we don't want to have happen going forward again when we talk about, slowing down the funding for health care at this table. And we've had a lot of talk about inflation. We don't know how bad it's going to be or how long it's going to last, but clearly it's coming at us like a freight train. And there's concern that healthcare costs might get impacted more so than anticipated. So there's some concern there. And I think that leads to one of several concerns that bring forth the question of, is this a good policy to skip the normal cost funding? So it's tied into some of our other presentations and concerns that have been expressed at the table dealing with financial markets and rates of inflation. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question may be for Ms. Ritchie. In the past couple of years, we have seen a decline in utilization in healthcare. Do you think that the utilization rates with the cost of inflation and without folks getting access to those early on services, that the utilization costs would be a little bit higher in the ongoing years? Would that have an impact upon our healthcare pension?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, this is Emily Ricci. You know, the pandemic, particularly 2020, really threw some dramatic changes in healthcare utilization across our health plans, and the retiree plan tended to follow the normal national trends, where there was a pretty large dip in like the April, May, June period, followed by an upswing. But what we're seeing right now is that upswing it's not spiking the way we anticipated. It's returning to previous levels, maybe slightly higher, but we're not seeing a big spike in the retiree plan. On medical utilization, and we are cautiously watching that because we're concerned that people may have put off care, deferred care, to catch conditions earlier in their disease progression, like cancer or something like that. But we haven't seen that cost pressure emerge on the retiree plan. The cost pressures that we're seeing emerge are really related to the prescription drugs, particularly specialty medication. And that's why when we talk so much about the work we've done with the group Medicare Part D prescription drug plan, that's really important because the subsidies and the manufacturer rebates that we've been able to leverage through the implementation of that program are really helping offset that spike that we're seeing in the like specialty drug utilization. We also implemented some changes effective January 1, 2021 in the retiree plan. We added preventive care, which has been long overdue for retirees. But we now have preventive care added to the retiree plan, and we've also added some specialty drug management programs at the same time. So we're trying to stay ahead of this. But we do anticipate some cost inflation in the future in the health plan. Right now, that is being offset through the work that we've done on the prescription drug savings program and the ratio of retirees that are becoming Medicare age eligible. Because once they become Medicare age eligible, Medicare pays on a fee schedule. So the cost for a service received drops pretty dramatically, and the plan is in a secondary position.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go on to the next slide, please.
Moving on to the slide number 15. And this is a scenario that we have put together. What if we were to infuse about $250 million or $500 million under the defined benefit pension trust fund. So the table below shows for 2023, the original preliminary healthcare trust contributions was $68 million, but because we did not, our board decided not to receive a contribution for the health trust, the pension trust only contribution is about around $34 million for the PERS and $284 million for the. I apologize, I'm jumping the gun here. The $34 million approximately, the contribution, additional state contribution required for the current year 2023. However, if you were to infuse $250 million. Instead of 33.9, we put $283 million. The projected contribution would change from 438 million to 260, nearly 265 million by 2039. And similarly, if you were to infuse $500 million on top of the $34 million requirement, the result is showing significantly low. Compared to $438 million, we will require $160 million with a difference of 322 less.
So I've asked the department to run these numbers. I just picked 250 and 500 out of the air. Because obviously, you know, you could have run any number you wanted, but I wanted the committee to see the benefits of an infusion and what it would do to the unfunded liability. Obviously, we want to get rid of the unfunded liability, you know, it's just something to consider if we have several years of strong revenue stream into the state. We certainly see the benefits of the additional $3 billion, rounded off, that we put in several years ago, and the benefits it brings to the table today. So what this chart is showing me on scenario one, that we would save $173 million and our annual outflow would be substantially less in that yellowish column. Is that how to interpret your chart?
That's correct.
Yeah.
We'll get on to terms. I do have one comment to the chair. So the results that we're seeing here are just for the additional state contribution portion, which would be the amount over the 22%. If the actuary calculates a rate over 22%, then the state uses a general fund to pay the additional state contribution. This doesn't take into account the savings that the state as an employer would save due to SB 55. So, David, do you have those numbers for scenario one and two on the state of Alaska as an employer, as additional savings as a result of the $250 and $500 million infusions?
Yes, I do. David Kirshner from Buck. So if we look at scenario one, which shows a savings of $173 million in an additional state contribution, in addition to that $173 million, there would be approximately $171 million in reduced state as an employer contributions. Because as Kevin Worley stated, under SB 55, the state as an employer now contributes the full rate. So that reduction would be $170 million. So when you add the $170 million in state as an employer contributions to the $173 million for additional state contributions, this total state contribution savings for scenario one for PERS would be about $344 million. So if you think about it, you contribute an extra $250 million now, and you would end up saving on a projected basis $344 million over the next 16 years. And then if we move to scenario two, the $322 million in additional state contributions, there would also be approximately $342 million in reduced state as an employer contributions. So the total savings in those years for the state contributions would be about $664 million. So you'd contribute an extra $500 million, and you'd end up saving $664 million over the next 16 years.
Okay, I think what's going to make it easier for us, because we got too many numbers floating around, I'd like to get this restated, and I'd like you to boil it down to the cash flow, net cash flow, that the committee can see. Because when we look at funding the retirement system, it's virtually a one line item. And the benefit that the committee members want to see is how much of a net cash flow change in the appropriation bill and bills going forward are we going to have per year, and then total savings. Because our ongoing operating budget eats those costs every year, and if we could minimize them. The other thing we are interested in is, when can we look at reducing that 22% and preferably eliminating it, so we get this, you know, unfunded liability issue basically behind us, so we're not constantly dragging the next generation in on the last generation's issues as far as who has to pay for what. So if you can help the, and I'm asking the guys at the end of the table, you know, if you could help us with that, so we just, because the committee is going to look at what's the net cash flow. We got 250 out. What's the benefit going forward on net cash?
Through the chair, we'll get that to the committee.
Yes, and then 500, and then and I'll get back to you if other members have other numbers they want to run, but it'll give us a ballpark, so then we could actually maybe refine, if there's interest, we could refine the numeric if we're thinking about doing a particular contribution. We're trying to look at all avenues to try to lower our forward expenditures, and save some money, and this is one of them. So it's in the very early stages of it. But this would impact every single municipality in the state and all the school system, all the schools. So it's a wide-ranging impact. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a great idea. I kind of shudder to think where we'd be had we not, had you not, in this committee, not had the vision to put in $3 billion just a few years ago. Our yearly costs would be so much bigger every year. So it's forward thinking. We've got seemingly a little bit of extra money this year. It seems like a very forward-thinking thing to do. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
Thank you. Moving on to page number 16, this shows a little explanation about some few zeros in the previous slide that you may have seen it. If you infuse about $500 million, the beginning of the few years, the rate drops below 22%. As a result, there wouldn't be any additional state contributions. But it just explains in this slide. Moving on to the slide number 17.
Okay, just a second. Could you back up? I have to admit it, I was daydreaming a little bit on another issue here on another slide. And I think this is an important slide. So could you repeat that for the chairman? And I apologize for drifting.
Mr. Chairman, this slide shows it shows a note, actually, that as you seen in the previous slide, there are a few zeros showing in the last column under the scenario 2, that in the years that PERS total employer contribution rate is 22 or higher, the state as an employer contributes the total contribution rate. Non-state employers contributes 22% because they're capped at that rate, and additional state contributions are additional state contributions are greater than zero, that number will show as an additional state contribution. However, in contrary, when the rate drops below 22% any years to the projection, then there will not be an additional state contribution required for the non-employers, non-state employers.
Okay. And the goal is to eliminate that 22%.
And goal is to eliminate that. That is correct.
Yes. I'm not saying we're going to get to our goal, but that's the goal.
Okay, moving on to slide number 17. This is very similar illustration for the TERS, Teachers Retirement System. The adopted rate for 2023 is $91 million. But again, if you were to infuse 250 on scenario 1 versus $500 million under scenario 2, you can see the significant saving in the last row at the bottom.
Okay.
Moving on to slide number 18. This slide shows the FY 2023 contribution rates for defined benefit plans, where all employees' contribution cost is 6.75% under PERS. Peace officer and firefighters' contribution rate is 7.5%, and school district alternate option is 9.6%. Employers' rate capped by Alaska statute is at 22%. And as we've seen in a previous slide, additional state contributions for the non-state employers is about 2.79%. That adds up to 24.79% total contribution rate for PERS. Similarly, on the TERS side, the employee contribution rate is 8.65. The capped contributions for the school district is 12.56. And the total rate is 24.62. So the difference, 12.06, is the state additional state contribution. Okay. Moving on to slide number 19, shows very similar chart for the defined contribution plan. Here, the employee rates are for both PERS and TERS is at 8%. Under PERS, the investment account, the employer pays 5% match. Healthcare at 1.1%. All ODD, which is occupational death and disability, for all other employees is 0.3%, and for peace officer and firefighter at 0.68%. And for the HRA, which is also known as the health reimbursement account that goes towards the health, the 3% of the all PERS and TERS average annual compensation as a flat dollar would be contributed for that. Any excess from the employer contributions out of 22% or for the TERS 12.56% goes towards the DB plans, defined benefit plans, unfunded liability. Okay. Chart number 20 shows just graphical illustration for the gap between the additional state contributions and the cap rate for PERS and TERS. As you can see it, the 2023 has the lowest gap due to the phenomenal return in the history, actually. And when we talk about the history, I'm talking about the history of even my own career that I have for 34 years. I have never seen in 42 plans that I have administered have returns of 30%. This is a true history.
The permanent fund had similar results, but we're confident that history can be repeated. We have all confidence in you that you'll sit at the end of the table sometime in the future. Give us good news like this again.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for the over speaking, but I would wish that this history continues and continue to break the records. Anyway, moving on to slide number 21. This chart simply shows the projected pension benefit recipient count. In 2023, we will be paying about 55,000 retirees monthly pension checks, as well as the peak will be in 2029 for combining both plans. In 2029, the PERS will be at 43,570 people, or the retirees, and for TERS in 2023 will be the highest number. We'll be paying out at 16,449. And the following chart shows the projected pension payment, benefit payments that we will be making. In 2023, we'll be making about $1.6 billion, and the highest amount we'll be paying in 2036, that will reach to $2 billion for both PERS and TERS.
Okay, and last year we talked about the length of the tail, and as I recall, there was the last of the Civil War beneficiaries had just passed away. So you want to highlight as a reminder why the tail is so long? It's clear to the end of the century almost.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, yes, that is true. The last expected payment will be received in 2102. These numbers, the year changes every year based on the demographics. But until we pay out the last beneficiary in the system, that will be 100 years from now, a little bit less than 100 years from now. But it's crossing the century.
And what year is that again? I can't read it.
2102.
2102.
80 years from now.
Okay, I hate to inform you, I will not be at the table, and neither will any of the members. So,
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Bishop.
I'd just like just to emphasize the total payments in 23 to retirees. It's 1.5 billion, 5.8 billion, is that right?
That is correct, sir, to the chair.
That's money that's going directly into Alaska's economy. But that shouldn't be lost on anyone.
For those that stay here, right, which is the majority, hopefully. Okay, we're on to 23, and we probably have a shot at getting done on time.
Yes, this shows the process timeline for how what it takes to set the rate for each year. Setting the rate for FY23, actually would use 2020 valuation and liabilities. The data extraction happens in August 2020, and they would use 2021 assets with actual rate of return. For 2022, they will project the expected rate, which is 7.38, and that's how they determine FY23 rate. And a few rows below shows the future year's timeline, just for information. Okay. Moving on to the slide number 24. This is something, as we know, that, you know, we had a great phenomenal year from a financial perspective, and we have a historical return. This slide also shows something that we have been enjoying for the past 2 years. And again, thanks to Emily Ricci and her team, bringing this significant savings as we expected when we initiated this program back in 2019 to get a savings anywhere between $40 to $60 million. And as you can see it in 2021, that number has been crossed beyond $60 million. We are at 64.4. And that's a huge saving as a result of the employer group waiver plan, AgWIP subsidy. Mr. Ricci?
Through the chair, Emily Ricci. I think the only thing I would note is that, again, this program was maybe one of the first programs that the division was able to implement working collaboratively with the retiree stakeholder group. And I think that's very important because, you know, over the last 3 years, we've improved those relationships with our retiree stakeholders so that they better understand the healthcare benefits, the rich healthcare benefits that they have access to, and we can engage in conversations about how to maintain those benefits and manage them to ensure that we are leveraging cost savings as possible. And there are very few programs where you can actually develop savings like this with actually a slight expansion in the benefits for the members. So we view this as a win-win, and we're looking for more win-wins in the future.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. And you had mentioned before that preventative care was now added for retirees. Can you just briefly explain what that care involves?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, this is Emily Ricci for the record. So I realized I misstated. I said preventive care was added January 1, 2021, and it was added January 1, 2022. So it was added this year, not last year. And preventive care includes the type of screenings that are regularly available to most employee plan members or most employees or active beneficiaries through their health insurance plan. So things like a wellness screening, cancer screenings, blood work, the regular checkups that you would expect. Historically, the retiree health plan contained provisions that had not been substantially changed for over 20 years. Changing those provisions can be very, very challenging because people are scared that they may lose their benefits and because we face litigation. So working with the retiree stakeholder group has really changed the dynamic of the division and allowed us to both implement programs that create savings and address some of the benefit gaps that we know are important for our retirees.
Just follow up
briefly, and I know there was a bill to address colonoscopies for those on in retirement but not eligible for Medicare. Is that something that's included in this?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, yes, colonoscopies, preventive colonoscopies are now covered. They're as are other colorectal screening.
You said they are now covered?
They are now covered.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Okay, we'll go on to the slide you guys have been looking for. Slide number 25.
Again.
Through the chair, looking at slide 25, these are some of the trend rates that our actuaries book use to predict kind of what the health plan trends will be in future years. In general, these reflect some of our plan experience. They also look at national plan experience and what's anticipated. So they do diminish over time, And part of that is due, again, to the effect of Medicare, but it's also largely due to actuary assumptions that assume at some point the growth in healthcare costs cannot exceed the growth in GDP. So looking out in future years, they assume that the healthcare costs will normalize.
Okay. We are, as mentioned earlier, the committee's concerned about inflation, dealing with our budget, dealing with the permanent fund, and dealing with our pension and healthcare benefits. So some of the questions today were aimed at that very thing. We don't know what's coming at us, but you know, we want to be prepared. Could you help the committee a little bit with, I know there was some discussion, I think, from what I've heard at the board about using just the market value and not using the actuarial return, actuarial smoothing value, and help me with do we have any, should we have any concerns with accounting principles or actuarial principles or anything of those natures dealing with the pension plan or healthcare plan in that discussion? And Mr. Kessinger, maybe you can help us with that, since so you're the actuary.
Yes, David Kirshner from Buck. First of all, on the accounting side, we don't have a choice. The GASB, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, issues their statements and requires that the financial statements for the state, as well as all the participating employers, measure the unfunded liability using the market value or fair value of assets. So we are not permitted from an accounting perspective to use a smooth value or an actuarial value. On the funding side, the choice is, up to the entity overseeing the management of the plan, which in this case is the ARM board. And as I said, the ARM board is attempting to help avoid volatility in the state's contributions that would be caused by market values going up and then down and then up and down. If we looked at historical market values, we would see patterns like that. And when the market values go up, the state's contributions would go way down and vice versa. So we use that smooth value specifically to smooth out the effect on contributions. If the decision was made to go to market value without a smooth value in the current year when we had a 30% return, we would see the state contributions for the next 2 years, projected contributions, would be considerably lower for the next 3 or 4 years, and then they would sort of normalize, because when we do our projections once we get beyond that smoothing period, our market values and actuarial values are the same, because we're not assuming any future market gains or losses. So you would, if you did move to strict market value, you would see a considerable decrease in the state's contributions in the next couple of years, absent, of course, any market corrections that might occur in those years. And then you would be subject, the state's contributions would at that point then be subject to volatility at the mercy of whatever the market returns were each year.
Okay, some of us have been around long enough to remember when the actuarial return or the smoothing method is higher than the market value. Now it's reversed. The good fortunes of the market, but we've always stayed the course and always have used the smoothing method. And I would expect that policy won't change. And if the ARM board decides to move to a market value, I think they would be invited in front of the finance committee fairly quickly. So, even the discussion didn't go unnoticed by some of us that have struggled with this for years. And we have the opportunity now to put a lot of the challenges that we faced the last decade and a half behind us. And we want to
We want to, I'm sure, all work together to accomplish that. So that's why I asked that question, and I just wanted to make it very clear. If we're to look at a way of reducing our cash flow going forward, the committee is more interested in looking at an equity infusion than playing the dicey game of using market value versus smoothing whenever it's advantageous politically. So I'm looking forward to the financial runs from the department. I really appreciate the presentation today. It's really nice to have a very positive presentation brought forward, you know, especially when we look back at some of the difficult years we've had at the table, and we've stayed the course all the time. Nobody's ever missed a benefit check or even come close. Nobody's ever going to. And we have the opportunity now to put less burden on the next generation going forward. So I'll meet with the committee members, and if they, you know, want other projections run, which is possible, we'll get them done and put this subject matter in the mix of other discussions and even of savings. And even if we decide, because there's other, you know, needs for the cash flow, if it's maintenance or other savings issues or whatever it is, dividends, what have you, that we will have set the table for the next legislature to pick up the conversation on an equity infusion. And I think we, you know, it's just an opportunity that doesn't come very often, and we want to make sure we fully understand it and we don't miss the opportunity when it's, you know, when we have that door open. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's refreshing to have this conversation again, prospectively looking at maybe able to do another infusion. It's been 8 years since we've been able to have this conversation. And I'll just go back off of memory, but if my memory serves me correctly, if we hadn't made that infusion, we would have been looking at $1 billion annual deposits from that year forward. It'd be nice to burn the mortgage on this one and be done with it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any final comments from the presenters today before you're out of the hot seat? Probably not too hot today, because this is very good news all the way around.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That concludes our presentation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, the next meeting will be Monday morning, 9 a.m. We're going to discuss two permanent fund dividend bills that are will be in the middle of the committee. So next week we'll have a lot of discussion on the potential changing the dividend formula and the dividends going forward to all the citizens and how we manage that issue. So we are adjourned at 10:34, and see everybody back 9 a.m. Monday morning. We are adjourned.